And, you know, you can imagine, like, that was one of the worst things to have to do. This person who I'm deeply in love with and see the rest of my life with, and have to carry her kicking and screaming into a car to bring her to an emergency room for psychiatric care. I was, you know, it was super, super traumatizing.
Mark Lukacs and his wife, Julia, began a life together, as many of us do, with youthful aspirations and dreams of adventure. But at 27, their world turned upside down when Julia fell into the clutches of a severe mental illness that sent shockwaves through their charmed existence.
I didn't learn this till afterwards, how bad that is for a marriage, to be in such a dynamic of power imbalance, where she was literally like told to sit on the bed and wait, and then forced to give her medicines by me.
Today on the show, Mark shares with remarkable vulnerability his family's journey through the harsh realities of staying committed through suffering. And he does so with a compelling reminder that true love often demands walking through fire together. I'm Kimmy Culp, and this is All the Wiser, a show about hope and possibility on the other side of pain. And today, about the complexities and caring for a loved one with mental illness.
So the story that I like to tell is that I heard about Julia before I actually even met her, because I had been in my freshman dorm at Georgetown in DC for every bit of an hour unpacking, and with other people stopping by and saying hi. And then this guy came by and he said, "Hey, have you heard that there's this girl from Italy who's like lives in our dorm?" And I was already kind of, even just from that, was like, oh, I think I have a crush on this person. Even though because just as a concept of this like sort of romanticized like an Italian girl studying in the US. And then when I met and saw Julia, I was like, oh, I'm done. This is it. I'm in big trouble. I'm going to be way too scared to ever actually talk to her. And so what I did instead is that I would yell at her, because at the time there was this very popular movie called La Vita è Bella, which is Life is Beautiful. And the main character in that, he, to his crush, he yells out to her like in any setting, "Buongiorno principessa," which basically means like, hello, princess. So I thought, you know what? That's what I'm going to do, because I'm too scared to actually talk to her. But maybe I'll just like try to charm her that way. And fortunately, it did, because she would respond back. And then we saw each other at a party. I'm not kidding. This is like the third week of college. And we hung out all night, and I walked her to her dorm, which was one floor below mine. I gave her a goodnight kiss. And pretty much since then, we have been Mark and Julia.
I love the image of you just yelling every time you see her walking across the campus.
Yeah, no, it was truly like that. Like, you know, 400 yards away, tons
just your
of people
little
out.
Flirty gesture.
Exactly. Yeah.
So there's the intrigue from afar, right? She's, as you said, this romantic notion of the girl from Italy moving to the US to study. She was young and beautiful. Mm-hmm. But when you get to know her, who were you falling in love with? What were the pieces of Julia that made you want to be with her, spend your life with her?
Totally. I would say that she's a super driven and just accomplished person. Like, even in high school, she was doing these ambitious summer internships at places. Meanwhile, I was like waiting tables and surfing during my high school and college summers. And she had, you know, a 4.0, and I was like sleeping through classes. And so we had a balancing effect, I think. I think I probably bring a little bit more of just like the natural, joyful approach to learning. Like, if it's cool, I'm going to be all in. But Julia just has a lot more of resilience and work ethic than I did. And so I felt like what worked and what I loved is that we complemented each other really well. Like I could convince her that her required intro to Buddhism class was actually awesome. And let's talk about it all the time. And she could make sure that I was getting my stuff turned in on time and not sleeping through classes, you know? And so it was just like a really nice pairing where we were both kind of cheering each other on. And I think seeing in each other things that we wanted. I was like, I probably need to tighten up my ship a little bit. And Julia was like, I probably need to relax a little bit more. Maybe just enjoy it all rather than just think about the goal that I'm aiming for. Because I would say in college, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And Julia very much knew what she wanted to do. And I would say, instead of that being intimidating to me, I actually found that pretty exciting and kind of reassuring of like, oh, you know, she's got a clear sense of her path. And I think I want to be part of that path. And so how will I fit into that trajectory? But then I just think about all the other little kind of small ways that it connected, you know, like if my parents came to visit, that was a big deal. And she got it. And she was like, I want to meet your parents because I know they're important to you. And so same thing when her parents came to the US, it was like the first spring. And it was like, yeah, this is a big deal because that's a big part of your identity is family, you know? And I think it's probably also why we started to very quickly in our relationship naturally start to define each other as family because we looked at our closest relationships as being family members. And it's like, yeah, we might have only been kids and just getting started in college, but we were taking care of each other and we were supporting each other. And that felt like what family does as compared to just what friends do.
After graduation, Mark and Julia dove headfirst into their happily ever after. Barely 24 years old, they got married, packed up the moving van, and headed straight to San Francisco, where they knew exactly one person.
And so when we got there, it was like chasing the sunset, going west, all of those just like cliched visions of romantic comedy relationships, you know what I mean? And it was awesome. I mean, we developed like a really nice friend group and we explored the city together and took advantage of the culture of it and lived out by Ocean Beach. So I was surfing all the time, which was amazing. And we got a dog. I was teaching high school, which is what I realized I always wanted to do. I just didn't know it. And it was really fun and exciting. And yeah, I think those are the best words. And to be honest, I think they also meshed with what I thought. Maybe you could say what I thought I was expecting out of life, but certainly what I thought relationships were. I thought, and this is a clear insight to how privileged and naive we were, but like I thought that being married to someone meant you have a lot of fun with them kind of all the time. And sure, you fight about a few things, but for the most sake, you're like feeling a really strong romantic attachment to each other and it kind of living in a montage of a movie rather than an actual scene of a movie, you know?
It was, you know, I heard you talk about writing Julia a letter when you were getting married about your promise of fun.
Yeah,
it's exactly. So clear that fun is something you value. It's something I value too, very much.
Yeah.
I like it in other people.
I think it's why I teach high school because that's a very fun job, you know?
Yes, yes.
I'm surrounded by cool, fun kids all day.
And that was this big promise you had to her that life is mundane. There's folding the laundry. There's waiting in line. And I promise you, we're going to have fun.
Exactly.
I'm going to make it fun. I mean, at that young age, that was how you were thinking about marriage. And not that I would imagine there's been and will continue to be a lot of fun in your life, but you're right that it speaks to the naivete of somebody in their 20s not knowing what's ahead,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and we did. We got slapped in the face by a 2x4. That was a total wake-up call that, in fact, when you love someone, there is a tremendous amount of suffering that comes with it. There's just the pain of the fear of loss, not to mention the actual loss that can happen when you care that much about someone. I wasn't really thinking about any of that. You know, let's not forget, we met when we were 18 years old and we started dating that early on. So we had almost no insight into what, like, being adults. We became adults together, you know?
As Mark shared, Julia was really smart and ambitious, and she had a very clear picture of what she wanted in life: to be a director of marketing at a fashion company and to have 3 kids by the age of 35. But then, at 27, Mark and Julia's world got completely turned upside down. It was 2008, and after a summer of cross-country road trips, Julia started a new job in San Francisco.
And I could immediately tell that for the first time since I had known her, that she was not fully confident in how she was doing at this job, that she was intimidated by the work, by the people she was working with. There was just this, like, kind of coolness factor that she hadn't quite encountered with other colleagues. So instead of giving me these, like, really self-assured, excited reports about her day, it was instead more of like a timid, yeah, you know, I had a nice day today, with a lot of quiet pausing in between, you know? That was sort of the beginning. Then it started to her not really being able to do a ton at her workday. I remember she used to call me from work in like a whisper and say, hey, I'm stuck writing this email. Can you help me, like, proofread it and make sure it's okay? And I was like, yeah, of course, just send it to me and I'll send it back to you. And I'm thinking it's this, like, big project email or whatever. And it's, you know, these very basic 2-3 sentence, hey, thank you for the meeting, I'm going to follow up on what you asked me to, kind of stuff, right? Just super, super basic. And she was getting really stuck on that. So we're not even talking about doing the ambitious work that she was capable of. We're talking about just, like, the very baseline ability to kind of keep moving forward with her day. And so that was really unexpected and concerning, to be honest. And we started to talk to each other, of course, about what's going on, what's happening, you know, but not really having any way to answer that question. And eventually, I mean, she stopped kind of eating too much. She was just kind of poking at her food and not really eating much. Then she stopped sleeping. And I'm giving you this step by step. This all happened quickly, you know, like between her first day of work and then me ultimately getting to the point where I brought her to the hospital, that was only a 6-week timeline. And the reason I brought her to the hospital is because after about a week of no sleep, I'd wake up and she'd often be pacing or just laying there with her eyes open. And eventually she started to explain that she was, like, having conversations with God at night or with the devil. And that's what really got me freaked out. And that's when I decided I needed to bring her to the hospital and she probably needed some sort of emergency care. I didn't know what that care was going to look like. I just knew that I was completely, totally out of my depth and there was nothing I could do anymore to help her.
Is that when her parents came out?
So her parents came out over the course of the 6 weeks because she was talking to them and was worried about what was going on. And they also didn't really know what to do. I think it was maybe a week or so before she ended up in the hospital that they got here. And we were all just, like, really worried and really had no idea what we were supposed to do to fix this problem, you know?
Was she going to work or was she?
She, like, kept calling in sick. And then eventually, I don't remember exactly how she stopped going to work. I think she just kind of was like, hey, I need to take a little break here, you know?
Yeah. And so what is the culmination of factors that lead to you and her dad eventually, physically, you had to get her to a hospital? And that alone is heartbreaking.
Yeah. So that was the morning she woke up and talked about how she had talked to the devil all night and that the devil was telling her that she basically needed to vanish, that she was causing all of the problems and that the best thing to fix all that would be for her to just die. And that's when I felt like, I mean, I didn't know, but that to me sounded like she was feeling suicidal maybe, or was being told to feel suicidal. And so I was like, we got to go to the hospital. I went to her dad, who's 6'7" and a former Olympian in water polo. And I was like, we got to get her to the hospital. And so together, she did not want to come. So we had to pick her up together, right? And like, he held her by the legs and I held her under the armpits. And she was, you know, very literally trying to hold into like doorways and doorknobs to prevent us from carrying her into the car. And then when we did get in the car and drove across the city to go to the hospital, in the middle of the drive, as we were driving through Golden Gate Park, she like popped open her seatbelt and like reached to open the door, you know? And so her dad had to reach over and hold her and further kind of keep her in the car so she didn't like throw herself out of a moving car. And, you know, you can imagine like that was one of the worst things to have to do, right? Is this person who I'm deeply in love with and see the rest of my life with and have to carry her kicking and screaming into a car to bring her to an emergency room for psychiatric care. You know, it was super, super traumatizing. I think for all of us, you know, I don't think for all of us, I know for all of us, it was just traumatizing in different ways. And then when we got to the hospital, they wouldn't even, she wouldn't get out of the car. So the front desk told me I had to call the police who would show up and arrest her and basically walk her into the hospital. And I basically was like ready to do it. I was like, Julia, I've got 911 on my phone. I'm going to hit call. And that was like when she agreed to get out of the car and walk over. And then, of course, from there, we have begun our very long and very convoluted journey through the American mental health care system.
One story I want to tell is a conversation you had with your mother-in-law about your wife, right? The love of your life and their daughter is unrecognizable, mm-hmm. and what that feels like for all of you.
Yeah. So what's really weird about someone, I didn't know the words at the time, but Julia was psychotic and she was, I'd never seen anything like this from someone who I knew closely and certainly not from her. So what's weird is you grieve this person as if they're gone because they're not the same in any way, but they are still very much alive. And what you don't know is this going to get better, right? And so there was one point where her mom basically said, this is even worse than if she had died because death at least feels final, you know? You have an ending there. But with this, I mean, being held against your will for 23 days is a super long time to be. That is a sign of just how deeply psychotic she was. And the answers we were getting were so, I mean, they weren't answers, you know? They were like, we're just as perplexed about this as you are. We're not sure what this means. We're not sure where this is all going to end up. And so that just like huge unknown made it so hard to just, I don't know, take it day by day, because I'm thinking, is this it? Is like for the next, I'm 27, is the future of my marriage a person who's like perpetually psychotic? I didn't know, right? Is she going to be better in a week? The deeper we got, the less hopeful I got about that. But I think I didn't expect Julia to ever fully come back. And I didn't know what she was going to be like when she was, quote unquote, better, you know? And so that was hard for me, of course. And it was also, of course, super hard for her parents, you know? She's their firstborn of two, the one who was going to be like the modern woman who had it all as like an amazing career and an amazing family. And then to see that all taken away, I mean, I know that this now as a parent, that how much you suffer when your children suffer, right? And so I think just this like not knowing, it was awful. It was totally awful.
And you, 90 minutes a day was at that time, you could go to the hospital for 90 minutes and be with her. Is that right?
Yeah. The visiting hours for the first one were in the evening and it was very regulated. And I put so much pressure. I like lived for that 90 minutes because I hoped that in that 90 minutes, I might either A, see a glimpse of Julia being better. B, I might be able to say something that could get her better or like decipher something to understand what was going on that I could then share with her doctor. Like I, being so unused to this, I almost felt like it was, you know, the daily goal was to make the 90 minutes a step in the right direction. Each visit, I wanted to feel like progress.
Like productive. We're going to solve
productive.
Something. We're
going to
chip away at this. Yeah,
exactly. That's exactly what I thought. And of course, instead, like sometimes she, I mean, there were some visits where she didn't want to talk to me at all. There was one where she said, I don't want you here. And I stood at her doorway for an hour and a half as she just laid in bed and stared at a wall. And I like felt like I had to prove to her that I wasn't going anywhere. But I just stood in a doorway for an hour and a half. And that didn't exactly feel productive, right? And then, of course, the one thing I will say in addition to that is as I would interrogate the nursing staff, I'd ask them a bazillion questions around my visits. When did she sleep? What was she eating? How's she engaging with others? Was she taking her medication by choice or what? And so they got to know me very well as a very insistent family member, you know? But I think that's what made it hard too, is because I did have this hope for progress and productivity with the timeline and the visits, and it not to happen. It was like a rejection every day that like, we didn't know how to fix this. You know, we were pretty powerless in this.
I think you're using the language now with so much ease, right? You're 15 years in, but I imagine at the time, the word psychosis, psychotic, they're all so heavy, these labels around mental illness, and scary. You're looking for answers, but at the same time,
the answers are horrifying.
The
right?
answers are scary.
Like when they first said, hey, we think she might have schizophrenia, I was like, oh, awesome. Thank you. Now you've like confirmed my worst possible fears of what this might actually look like, you know?
Yes.
And so like what they were saying made it even worse. And I think that's another reason why it was almost harder, because every like possible explanation was a really hard one. None of them were, hey, she's going to be okay. Like we figured out the medication that's going to have her be fine and she'll be back to work in no time and you guys will be able to have children like you always dreamed of and all this other stuff. Like, none of the answers pointed in that direction.
Julia spent 23 days at the hospital. She was finally given a diagnosis and discharged into Mark's care. And now Mark is thrown into an entirely new role, the role of full-time caregiver. We'll share all those details after a quick break. Hey, listeners, thank you for listening to my conversation with Mark. This is the last season of All the Wiser, and I have a favor to ask you. We have this big dream of putting together an episode with all of your reflections on this podcast. If you're a regular listener, or if you're just listening for the first time, we would love to know, how have you been changed by the stories you've heard on All the Wiser? Was there a guest or an episode that you will never forget? A piece of wisdom that you brought into your own life? Let us know. You can call or text us at 310-243-6364 or send us an email at hello@allthewiserpodcast.com. You can also DM us on Instagram at All the Wiser Podcast. It really means the world to us. So thank you. All the Wiser is a one-for-one podcast. For every episode you hear, we donate $2,000 to our guest favorite charity. Mark chose to support Access Institute. Access Institute is based in San Francisco, and it provides high-quality psychological care to people of all ages with the greatest need and least access to care while training the next generation of mental health professionals. You can find out more about their work at accessinst.org. That's accessinst.org. So yeah, tell me about the weeks and months after she came home.
So the typical step down from acute hospitalization is to go to some sort of outpatient program. And so they enrolled Julia in a program that met 3 days a week from basically 9 to 12, or it was like 9:30 to 12:30. But otherwise, she was home and she wasn't working and there was no other structure in her day. And she went from being psychotic, which was able to be controlled by antipsychotic medications, to then becoming deeply, deeply depressed to the point of expressing suicidal ideation almost like all the time, talking about how she didn't want to be alive and how she just wanted to die. And this was too painful to deal with. And so, of course, I did not think she felt safe to be home alone. So I filed under the Family Medical Leave Act for a 3-month leave from my job. And I basically, this all happened in September. And so I basically took the first semester of school off. And so, you know, 3 days a week, Julia would go off to the outpatient program where she was in group therapy or individual therapy or seeing a psychiatrist to tweak the meds. But then the rest of the day, it was just the two of us. And, you know, when she's gone, it's the worst thing in the world because I miss her so much and I just want her to come home. It's such a declaration of how unnormal things are that she's not home. But when she's home, it is so demanding and it is so exhausting when she comes home from that being out of a hospital. Because once again, like my first instinct was to kind of like be the fixer, you know? And so I was trying to like, hey, let's go to this yoga class and let's go play tennis and let's go walk the dog and let's do XYZ and fold the laundry together and cook and all these other things to like keep her active. And the truth is those are good things. Those are healthy things to be doing. But I didn't have any understanding of what depression was and how all consuming that was for her. And unfortunately, I don't think I had much patience for what depression is. I felt like I think I'd given up on the idea that you're weak if you struggle with your mental health, but I also felt like I didn't concede to being passive, right? I was like, I got to do something. I got to make something out of this time.
You talked about in one interview, which I loved, this idea of the waves and her waves, and you would almost view her the darkest ones, right? The suicidal ideation is like, oh, there's a spark, I gotta put it out.
Yep.
And that changed for you. Can you share that?
Totally. Yeah. So I'm not exaggerating when I say we had a daily conversation about the value of staying alive. Because when Julia would express her suicidal feelings, those are the ones that scared me the most. And so I jumped on them and I was like, no, but remember, like, think of all the good things we have and think of how wonderful our future is going to be. There's no reason to be suicidal. And I would try to convince her out of it. And eventually she would stop talking because I wasn't really listening. I was more kind of like rejecting and trying to just suppress the feeling. But that didn't mean she actually felt better, right? It didn't mean she sort of like experienced the emotion to therefore let it go. And eventually there was one night where she brought up again, Mark, I want to die. I don't want to deal with this anymore. And I was just so tired. I was like, I just don't have it in me to do my usual convincing spiel of why you should stay alive. So I just sat there and I just basically let her talk. And I realized as we were talking, it's really scary to hear someone say they want to kill themselves. But also, I was in the room with her. There was no way she could actually act on killing herself. Like, she was safe in that moment, despite how hard her feelings were. And so I just shut up and listen. And after kind of talking herself out, then that was the first time where she actually said, I feel better. Thanks for letting me talk. And I learned how important it is to, of course, be with someone to make sure they're safe, but actually feelings alone, there's nothing wrong with them. It's how, what you do with the feelings. Like, if you're feeling suicidal and you act on it, then of course we want to keep you safe. But if you're acting suicidal, maybe we just need to honor that. And maybe we just need to give you the space to experience it and not shut you up and judge you and convince you otherwise. And in fact, if you can just live in the feeling, then that's how you can, rather than let the feeling control you, you can be more in harmony with it. You know, and I learned that for myself too, because I was going through a lot of feelings at this time as well. I was feeling mad that this had happened. I was feeling guilty that I wasn't sick. I was feeling like sad, obviously, heartbroken. And instead of just sort of putting those away, I let myself feel those way. Now, I didn't let myself feel those way in front of Julia, because in front of Julia, I had to project optimism. At least I felt like I did. But I went to see a therapist. Julia was falling asleep super early on her meds. So I had a lot of like nights to myself. And I was like, you know, even though I'm a person who I think by my natural composition is a pretty optimistic and upbeat person, I was just kind of feeling like shit, sitting on the couch, and I was not trying to convince myself otherwise.
You know, as you've said, you were having this really fun, charmed life, and you're not working, and your job is really keeping her alive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important that people understand the sort of nuanced minutiae of what that looks like.
Mm-hmm.
The medications, the negotiation around the medications, the side effects of the medications, in your case, hiding because she's suicidal,
yep.
Being in charge of the medications, also being in charge of hiding the medications. So that role of not the joy-filled, fun husband, but now you are a nurse.
Yeah, I don't really want to say Nurse Pratchett, but not quite not Nurse Pratchett either, right? Like, so her first suicidal outlet was the idea of overdosing on her pills. She didn't want to take the pills because she hated the side effects. They made her sluggish. They made her gain weight. She hated that. But she was also okay with just taking the whole bottle and like killing herself. So of course, what I did was I was like, all right, well, you have to take your pills and you can't kill yourself. So in our little two-bedroom apartment, I would hide the pills and move the pill hiding location around every few days. So basically our routine was sit her on the bed, close the door, put on this like performance of walking through the house for 10 minutes so she couldn't hear where I had gone. Therefore I will have gone everywhere. And then eventually scoop up the dosage, bring it back with the cup of water, make her take the pills, make her open her mouth to show me that she had swallowed because she was getting good at hiding them under her tongue or under her lip. And it sucked because that is no way to be married to someone, right? Like, I didn't learn this till afterwards, how bad that is for a marriage to be in such a dynamic of power imbalance, where she was literally like told to sit on the bed and wait and then forced to give her medicines by me. And I know why I did it. And guess what? I'll do it again if I have to, right? I'm not going to let her go off her meds. I'm not going to sit back and passively grant her permission to overdose on her meds. And so like, if I have to do that again, I will. But it's awful because I was clearly in charge and she clearly wasn't.
Yeah.
And this is her mind and her body that we're talking about.
And when you talk about the side effects, this yeah. is not like, oh, my skin's a little flush. I mean, no. she's 70 pounds of weight and yeah. drooling, and she feels like she's comatose.
Totally. It was yeah. awful. It was awful to see her medicated like this. And I didn't know what the other option was, right? I was like, this is what the doctor's telling us to do. We just got to do it and hope you get better. And it was clear, like, you know, there's multiple antipsychotic options. And so they went with the strongest one and in a heavy dose, and it was probably too strong for her, right? For a while. And so then they shifted to one that wasn't strong enough, but instead made her all weepy and just like all the tweaking of the meds. It's such a up and down ride for the person who lives with it and who has to actually put the medicine in her body. And I was the one who had to be the face of giving it to her. You know, in groups, she made some friends and they used to call me the medicine Nazi because I was the one insisting that she take her pills every morning and every night.
You know, I think it was in your book, you know, you said I could hide the pills, but I couldn't hide the Golden Gate Bridge. And it gave this glimpse of sort of what you would come home to or walk into on an average day.
Yeah. So unfortunately, you know, what I've learned about suicidal ideation is that you often fixate on one method, right? And that's why preventing access to that method can be life-saving. So for example, if someone who might have knives and medication nearby, but wants to shoot themselves, if you take away the gun, you might be keeping them safe because they're not going to consider other methods. So like with Julia, I didn't feel like I had to hide knives because she never talked about that, but I felt like I had to hide pills. But then in group, she found out that overdosing is actually rarely successful, quote unquote, in that instead of actually killing yourself, you often just inflict like pretty severe brain damage, but still stay alive. So she kind of shifted off of that. And then being in San Francisco, she instead thought, oh, well, there's the Golden Gate Bridge. Why don't I just jump off of that? And so that became her kind of like fixation. And while I was home, it was fairly easy to keep her away from going to the bridge. But eventually I did have to go back to my job. And I did have to, in going back to work, spend most of the day in complete terror that she might be going to the bridge and might in fact be trying to kill herself. And one day I came home from work and she was like, she was sitting in our bedroom. She was kind of like clearly in thought. And I was like, what's up? You know, something's clearly up. Are you okay? And she's like, well, I think I figured it all out, but I don't know what I'm going to do with the key to the scooter. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And so she says, well, when I take the scooter to the bridge, I'll park the scooter and I'll go and I'll jump off. But like, we only have one key to the scooter. So I don't know, do I leave the key in the scooter? Because if I do, someone's going to just take the scooter and then you lose the scooter. And but then she's like, but if I bring the key with me, what if they don't find my body? Then you still lose the scooter. So she's like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do with the key. And you know, that is like, what do you say to that? Right? Yeah. You're like, you've got this so planned out and the loss of your own life feels less important than the loss of our scooter. And it was just brutal. And it was, you know, it was at that point that I was like, okay, I still have to stay at work, but I, you know, I really started to try. I found someone who I could hire to keep her company and make sure she was safe. So not fun conversations to have with someone you care about.
In total, it was about 9 months before Julia reached a place where the psychosis was no longer a problem. After the initial month in the hospital, she was an outpatient for 8 months while doctors were trying to mitigate her suicidal depression. They kept tweaking her meds, and eventually they took her off the antipsychotics, which helped a ton because the antipsychotics were what was actually amplifying her depression. This is when Julia really started to blossom. And within 3 days, she was completely restored to herself. the Julia from before the psychotic break.
The diagnosis that they had was major depression with psychotic features, which they hoped would be a one-off, but also they cautioned, yeah, but 90% of people who have psychosis experience it in a recurring basis. It's not a one-off thing. But Julia and I were very keen to think, oh yeah, but we are obviously in the 10%. Like, look at how good our life has been up to this point. You're not going to have to deal with this again. You're going to be fine. And so she was on like a mild antidepressant, and that was pretty much it, and doing just fine.
And there was no genetic like predisposition or nothing? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that was one of the big things that I and my mother-in-law were like hoping to do was like, could we track something down and share some piece of info that would explain things? And there really was nothing, you know, like there's no family members, none of it. This just totally came out of nowhere for her. And so we were thinking, okay, yeah, maybe like 50 years ago, we would have called this a quote unquote nervous breakdown. And, you know, people move on from that and they get their lives back. And so we were thinking we were going to be fine and get back to life. And although we knew there was the possibility of relapse, we didn't particularly worry about it. And so coming out of the episode, I'd say thinking about the future, we saw a restoration of our future. But in the present, it was a really hard time to be married to each other because I think that the power imbalance that I had talked about earlier was hard to readjust to and to even accept in the first place. You know, like Julia had felt really controlled by me. And I was like, cut me a break. I was trying to keep you alive, you know? And also I was, I think, going through a lot of post-traumatic processing that I had not done publicly in front of Julia. But now that she was better, I felt like, can you take on some of my emotional experience now? And she did not particularly want to deal with that because she had just gone through the worst 10 months of her life, you know? So it's like, we were just in really, really different spaces. And actually what we did to try to reconnect is we took a round the world trip together for 4 months just to really get out of our situation, you know, and just be adventuring together because that brings so much capacity for connection and also fresh perspective on things, you know? And so we had a really amazing trip. And I think in the culmination, we did feel recommitted to each other. And we felt once again, like hopeful about our future as a couple.
Well, it makes so much sense when you talk about actually her getting better creates a whole new chapter, especially for you.
Yeah.
Because now you have the time and space to actually feel, not feel, but you know, the resentment. I would imagine that that's harder to balance and express when she's in the throes of it.
Totally.
So here she is trying to like on-ramp back to life and you're like, well, wait a second. Like I am all these things, right? Like mad, sad, broken, unseen, unheard. And here she is like, I'm back. How much memory does she have during the psychosis and after? Because I would imagine that piece reconciling as well, where you have much more memory than she does, I would imagine.
Yeah. All great questions. Julia has a pretty vivid memory of moments for sure. She definitely remembers the hospital very well. And she remembers what it's like to be psychotic. It's not like those memories are gone. She tends to laugh about them when she talks about them because I think she sees how bizarre they are. But I don't think she necessarily can appreciate how what it is to not laugh about those. Because like when it's happening, I'm certainly not laughing, you know? But, you know, a year on, she's like, wow, wasn't that crazy how I thought that this other guy was God and that I was the devil. And so I had to like prove myself to him. Isn't that just so weird? And, you know, and I'm like, yeah, that was really weird. And I was literally in the hospital as you were doing that and processing that by myself all day. And trust me, I don't think it's funny, you know?
Yeah.
So there's that. Now, What I appreciate that you said is you said it makes sense that I would have all these hard feelings. But the funny thing is, I don't think it didn't actually make sense to us that after she got better, I was going to feel so bad. And it definitely didn't make sense to Julia, who was like, can I just have some fun and live now that I've gotten through the worst thing I've ever gone through, you know? But I think the two words you said that really stuck with me the most were the unseen and the unheard. Because I think with my therapist, I was able to process feeling the guilt and the anger and the sadness. But I think that with Julia, I needed to be validated. I needed her to know. I had truly centered my entire life around her and what was happening for her. And there was very little awareness of what that was like for me to navigate. You know, like it was a lot of work to manage family, you know? And I had to deal with the fallout from her stopping her work. I was dealing with the logistics of my work. And like all this stuff, I don't think she had seen at all. And so I think that what I needed most coming out of it was, hey, do you see me? Do you see what I went through as you went, what you went through? Because I saw what you went through and I tried to help you, but I need to know that you saw me too.
Yeah.
And I don't think she did. And I don't blame her for that. But what was hard is I think it took her time to embrace that maybe she did need to see me a little more.
Yeah. I think a lot of people who have been caregivers will really resonate with that.
Yeah. I know that's the case because that honestly became the impetus for me to write, because on top of all of the bad stuff, there was a pervasive sense of loneliness because I couldn't find anyone else who was speaking to what I was going through, who could make me feel like I wasn't the only person on earth doing this. And I knew that there weren't, because there were other patients in the hospital. And I'm like, all these people have other people in their lives who are like me. Where are they? How can I connect with them? How can I read their story or whatever, or just like feel validated, you know? The reason I ended up actually writing about all this is multifaceted, but like definitely one of it was to try to give a voice to an under-expressed experience. But I also think on a micro level, it was so Julia could hear what I was going through,
yeah.
You know, because when we'd sit in the room and I'd start talking about it, those conversations never went well. So I like tried by writing her a letter because I felt like I can polish my thoughts more if it's written down, and she can read it when she's in a space where she's open to hearing it. And it actually turned out that writing to her rather than talking about this allowed us to talk about it, because the first opening was not me standing in the room crying and her feeling defensive or judged or whatever. Instead, it was like, here's this. I just want you to read it when you feel ready to, and then let's talk about it afterwards. And so that became, I think, a really key way for the two of us to move forward and for me to start feeling more seen.
Yeah. So you do move forward and decide to start a family.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine there's a lot of conversation and thought about, well, just the risk of all of it, right? Her future mental health and postpartum and genetic predisposition. How do you get back on track and committed to building a life together? And what did that look like?
Yeah, you know, I think that honestly, like, I think our youthful optimism was back pretty strongly. And I think although we were aware of the possible concerns, I don't want to say we ignored them, but I don't think we let those stop us. So like we looked at, should she stay on medications? What medications can she take while pregnant that are fine for the baby, but also keeping her stable? What could she do around breastfeeding with regards to medication? What should we consider around her job and returning to work? And I think basically the plan we came up with is that I would be the stay-at-home dad. I realized by caring for Julia that there's a lot of like crap that comes with it, but like caregiving is sort of a part of who I am. And Julia still was very much career driven, you know, in her return to health, she got back into work. And so the idea was, okay, take a long medical leave and then get back into work. I would be home with the baby. We would figure out the plan after that. I was just like completely not working at the time. And honestly, it was all going pretty darn smoothly. Like the pregnancy itself was great, no issues. Baby came out healthy. Really great maternity leave at home with the three of us together. And then return to work was a disaster. And she had relapsed. I think she was only back like 6 weeks, if at that, before she was back in the hospital.
It was about 3 years between Julia's first and second hospitalizations. And it wasn't until she'd had the second episode that the doctors realized that the initial diagnosis of major depression with psychotic features was not the right diagnosis.
They were like, oh, this is probably bipolar disorder, so let's put her on lithium. Lithium is what she takes to this day. Instead, she was on an antidepressant, and a lot of people with bipolar actually taking just an antidepressant can actually amplify the onset of mania rather than like keep it away. And so it hit hard and it hit fast. And now I had a 5-month-old baby at home.
So they put her on an antidepressant after mm-hmm. the pregnancy and it bumped her up into mm-hmm. mania.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
So had she had the proper diagnosis, she would have been on mood stabilizers.
Probably. Yeah. And that's what she took then and still takes. So she's been on lithium for, 14 years now, but not 15 years, you know?
How long was her second stay?
Second stay was longer because that was 33 days. She was mostly better probably after about 3 weeks. But that team was being really cautious because we had a baby at home. And so in the first day when she came home after 23 days, she was still kind of intermittently psychotic. But this time around, they're like, we're not going to let you come home like that with a baby. You know, that's just too much.
Yeah.
So they really wanted to make sure that she was not, at least not psychotic. She was still depressed, but at least not psychotic.
And could she see Jonah or be with Jonah?
You mean in the hospital?
Yeah. Because obviously you're caring for a baby
mm-hmm.
and then even trying to keep him connected to her or even mm-hmm. that aspect of managing her maternal relationship with Jonah.
So kids are not allowed in any psych ward that we've been to. All of them prohibit kids 14 and under. So originally it was a no way you're allowed to see him. But I talked to the doctor as that sort of like unrelenting pain in the ass family member that I can be. And they set up like a side room that other patients did not have access to. And they allowed me to bring Jonas into the hospital. Like I would basically go in, set the room up. My mother-in-law was there at the time. And then she would like wheel him in the stroller. And then we could all be together for the visits. We didn't do this for every visit, but we did do it for some. So she was able to see him and he was able to see her. But then at home, they just were in such different. I mean, what a 5-6-month-old baby needs is so different than what someone who's suicidal needs.
Yeah.
And what they want, you know? And so while I'm doing the like cooing at the baby and singing and dancing around the house and finger painting and getting a huge mess. And Julia's just kind of like sitting on the couch watching it.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, that was really, that was very heartbreaking.
I'm curious about your friends and your community. You know, one is just mystery and shame and judgment, all of these really murky waters around mental illness. And we've talked about it in past episodes that, you know, if Julia was up against breast cancer or cancer that kept coming back, my guess is there would be meal trains. And, you know, how did your friends and your community experience, or how did you experience them? Mm-hmm. Were people timid? Did people show up? Did people say things, not say things? I think it's different when it's a mental illness. It's totally different.
Yeah. It's completely different. And I found it's honestly, it was too much work because let's say I asked a friend to be with Julia so I could step away for a little bit, right? Well, it took usually at least a half an hour, if not an hour phone call before the visit to like answer their questions of what to expect and how to respond in different situations. Then I'd be gone for 2 hours. And then the person would immediately want to call me and process everything that had happened because it was the first time they were seeing Julia like this and how it felt for them. And it ended up being just too much work for me to like welcome too many people in because like me, they didn't know what to do, you know?
Yeah.
And they were looking for guidance. So they assumed I could provide it. And I was just like, I just don't have the bandwidth to do this. And so by and large, we mostly stuck to ourselves.
And so there are these periods. So the two episodes and there's been three more as recently as a few months ago, mm-hmm. the stretches in between, you know, one of the things when you and I were talking, what was when we first talked, I love it because I said, you know, what lights you up and when you talk about it, because that's what I want to bring to the conversation. You know, our listeners feel that. And one of the things you said was a really simple, beautiful answer, which was, I love talking about loving Julia.
Yeah.
And we obviously have talked a lot about psychosis and all of the darkness and insanity that has come in those chapters, but it'd be a disservice to not talk about what's in between, and it's just the type of mother and person she is.
Yeah, totally. I'm glad we're doing that, you know? So to zoom out and give the full perspective and then to do the important work of filling in the gaps. Julia was hospitalized in 2009, 12, and 14. So 3 times over 5 years. And those to me feel like a kind of self-contained period of our lives, right? Where we were first dealing with this and learning what it meant to be a family with mental illness. And there was gaps in between, but they were all kind of chapter one, if you will. And in fact, that is the focus of my book. I wrote the book after the third episode and published it after the third episode. And then we had 8 years of stability, which is a long time. You know, during that 8 years, Jonas went from a baby to a, you know, a kid. We have a second child. Julia had a super great, robust return to work life and was crushing it like she always had and is a fun, engaged mom. And like, we, you know, goof around together a ton as a family and play board games and go skiing and do all the fun stuff, you know, and she's up for all of it. But I would say that for a big chunk of it, Julia was kind of the vision of life that she had wanted. It wasn't quite the job title or the 3 children, but it was a happily, healthy, working mom. And, you know, I also think we kind of fell into this. We sort of convinced ourselves that by writing a book about this and sharing it with the world, we had sort of put a bow on the package and we had contained the illness into this 300-page book. We had made sense of it. we had...
You're like, we wrote the end chapter.
Exactly. Exactly. We had ended it.
You ended it. Yeah.
And interestingly, the book does end open-ended, knowing that bipolar might come back. But I actually think that deep down, neither of us thought it was going to come back. And as every year went by and it didn't, and then we like went through COVID lockdown, which was the most stressful thing in the world for so much of us. And that still didn't trigger an episode. I was like, oh, I think we're good. Like, I think we found the way to manage bipolar. I think at least Julia's bipolar, you know, the combo of having a really great therapeutic relationship, taking her medication consistently, and doing the right behavioral stuff, advocating for her stuff at work. And so like we had the behaviors in place to manage stress and support sleep and all of that. And it felt like we had sort of created the path that worked. And then in May of 2023, very, very much out of the blue, Julia had yet another relapse and once again was back in the hospital. And then what was so shocking about this one was that she never really came out of the depressive state, but then slipped right back into another psychotic episode. So here we are, it's February of 2024, and it was only May of last year, and then November, 6 months later, that she had two hospitalizations. And so, you know, that 8 month period in between was where we got to reconnect as a couple.
The 8 year, you mean?
The 8 year period. Yeah. Like we had kids, we loved having kids, and also our kids were growing up. And so we could, I mean, you know how it is when your children are small, they take everything that you have, right? You need to give them everything. And it's amazing, but you have very little time to invest in your marriage, right? And so we were just starting to once again not have to change diapers and deal with all that stuff and be like, hey, we can be married to each other again. And we were excited about that. And I think I in particular was excited about that because I feel like caregiving came crashing into my life in 2009. And it was pretty much a decade because it was taking care of Julia and then it was taking care of one child and then both sick Julia and a child. And then we had another child where I was once again a stay-at-home dad. So like basically I felt like a decade for me was I am Mark the caregiver, you know? And then it was like, hey, the caregiving isn't as central to me anymore. Maybe I can go back to like joining a men's soccer league again, which I hadn't done in 10 years, and seeing friends for dinner sometimes, which I hadn't done in 10 years, you know? And going on date nights with Julia, which we hadn't done in a long time. And so like, we were just like, I think being your more quote unquote typical 21st century two working parent couple, you know, with problems that felt more like what you read about in the New York Times when they talk about parenting in the modern era, as compared to what you read about in, you know, like studies about families navigating mental illness, you know? Yeah.
How the boys are 11 and 5.
Mm-hmm.
How do you talk to them about it? Communicate what's too much, too little?
Yeah.
How have you figured out that truth and that narrative with the boys?
That's a great question. It's very different for each boy. I'll start with Cosimo. So he's 5. He had no, even in his subconscious experience of her being sick. And so when she first started going psychotic, she was actually very affectionate with him and doting on him. And so I actually think he kind of loved it because mom was all about him and all into him. Then when she had to go to the hospital, he was very sad about that. And, you know, every night it was crying about how much he misses mom and when is she going to come back? Why can't he go visit her? That sort of stuff. And that was obviously brutal. Jonas was alive. Now, he was an infant and then a 2-year-old, but he does somewhere deep down inside him, he experienced his mom being gone and sick. we had explained that mom has bipolar and that it's not something you can see, but it's something that's more about how you feel and think, and that she goes to therapy. Like, he knew that, but it was still the way he put it. When she started to relapse, I took Cosimo to swim practice and I brought Jonas with me, and we were in the parking lot, and I said, "Hey, how do you think mom's doing right now?" And he said, "I think mom is really trying to be nice to everyone, but it feels like she's trying too hard." Thank God I was wearing sunglasses, because I was like bawling as he's telling me this, you know? And I was like, "Yeah, you know, because you know how mom is bipolar? Well, I think she's really experiencing it right now. And so I think, Jonas, it's going to be hard for a little while. And I think she might be able to stay at home, but she might not." And so I was able to kind of preview for him about things. Now, for him, though, appropriately so, he was kind of thinking about himself. He was playing.
Yeah, he's a kid.
He was playing Little League. And he's like, am I going to have to miss Little League? He had a birthday party scheduled to have two friends sleep over. And he's like, "Can the kids sleep over while mom's home like this?" And I was like, I don't think so. And so actually, when I took her to the hospital, he asked me like the next day, "Hey, if mom's not home, can I have my sleepover again?" And I was like, "Yeah, I think you can." And so he was very much seeing it through. A kid who's worried about his mom, he would say he's scared and wants to make sure she gets better. But he also was like, "You know, I got a baseball game and I'm about to graduate fifth grade and I've got this play that I'm in." And he was really, it was a very busy time in his life that he was just kind of going through all that, you know? Now, this second episode that came back in November, 6 months later, it was a little easier for them because they had just seen her like this. And so they kind of knew, okay,
knew what to
mom's going to be gone for a little while, but she'll come home and she might be a little bit more like withdrawn when she comes home, but it'll be okay. You know, all that sort of stuff.
You choose Julia and your family over and over again. And you're really, I think, thoughtful and self-aware, and I think really conscientious when you've been interviewed about your book, that this isn't everyone's path to stay when things are this hard, and you choose to stay. You also choose to be incredibly honest and transparent about how messy and hard that is and how much suffering you witness and endure. But you really talk about this choice in a really beautiful way. I heard in one interview comparing it to the choice to teach. So for people who say, "I couldn't do it," what is your explanation, your reason to stay and continue to show up?
Yeah, I it's honestly gotten a harder question to answer. And it's not because I don't know the answer. I just don't know how to say it. It just, I trust that that's what I am supposed to do. I mean, I'm in my 40s. I've been in love with Julia for more than half my life. Knowing that Julia has bipolar and that it's bumpy and hard, I choose that over no Julia every day forever, you know? But also, like, Julia takes her pills when you give them to her, and she sees how being sick needs, that she needs to make some choices even if she doesn't want to. And I know that not everybody does that. You know, I have a friend who, his brother was hospitalized and the whole family was so concerned, and they all flew to LA where the brother lived. None of them lived in LA. They were all living out of a hotel while he was in the hospital. And the day that he was discharged, he came out of the hospital, basically refused to engage with them, threw his medication in a trash can, got on a bus, gave everyone the middle finger, and vanished, you know? And it's like, Julie's never done that. As hard as it's been, she also shows up. She doesn't, has never tried to run away or any of that. And so it's like, I'm not the only one doing that in this relationship. We both are. And that's why I feel like it's inevitable in a way.
And your boys have to witness that, which is incredible and not easy. Where has been the growth and the goodness that has come from this? If that's a fair question.
Yeah. You mean the whole thing?
Yeah, just in general. I mean, when I have heard you speak and be interviewed, a lot of this wisdom, right? About actively listening, about allowing everyone to be seen and heard. You know, I think we're so quick to cast good and bad in a story, and it's so nuanced. It was hard won, but it's won. And I think my guess is your kids will be very wise seeing that talked about and modeled.
I hope so, right? You know, I'm reminded of when I was 27 and I took my leave off of work. I felt this, I loved the school that I worked at the time. And we had it was a Catholic school. So there was a weekly chapel gathering, and oftentimes people in the community spoke, and I felt this obligation to explain to them where I had been. And I didn't get into details, but I did tell them that my wife had been sick and I was caring for her. And I remember afterwards, a colleague of mine who had lost her husband, she came up to me and she was crying and she said, "You're too young to be this old." And you ask, what did I get out of this? I feel like my body is still relatively young, but I do feel like my spirit has grown so much because I do know that love is suffering and I'm not afraid of that. I don't withhold love because I'm afraid that it might hurt. And I hate to sound like moralizing about the society we live in, but I do feel like a lot of what we do enables shallow relationships rather than deep ones. And it allows easy outs rather than hard commitments, you know? And I think there's so much more learning you get from sticking through your commitments to people. And as far as my kids, I mean, the thing is, I'd like to think I'm role modeling the things you say, but unfortunately, I also think I role model fatigue and burnout to them because it is hard. I mean, November into December, Julia was only hospitalized for 12 days, but then for the first time, they didn't put her in an outpatient program. They put her in an inpatient recovery program when she was there for almost another month. And so it was wonderful for her. It was amazingly therapeutic and beneficial to her. But I was home with just the children for 6 weeks and I was working through that. And that was really, really, really tiring, really long and tiring. And I'm still tired from it. And so unfortunately, I think that, well, I'd like to think they see a dad who will do no matter what to protect his family. I think they also see a dad who's really tired by it.
Yeah. And that makes you human.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I mean, of course, but like, I still can't wish that I could be the dad in Totoro who every time I watch that movie, I feel like, God, this guy is able to be so positive for his children. And I try, but I'm never quite that positive, you know?
Our show is about hope and possibility on the other end of pain and then through it again, right? What do you hope people take away from your story that listeners feel comforted by?
Well, I think if you're going through something that has very clear similarity in the specifics, and my guess is there's way more of people out there than even I can recognize, I hope you at least don't feel alone. Because in 2009, I felt so desperately alone. Since I've been writing about this publicly and, you know, had to, you know, the book come out and different, and I have like an email address where people can email me. It's like, it's been amazing to see how many people there are who are like, thank you for speaking out and making my experience feel seen. So I certainly hope for that. But I think, like, to the broader, if these specifics do not apply to you, I hope that, I don't even know how to say this. I feel like it's worth it. Loving someone is worth it, period. And I think that we know that, but I've lived that. And even though it's been super hard, it's just worth it. And so I hope that people in whatever relationships they're in, whether that's romantic like mine is, or friendships, or with family members, even though all relationships have thorns, when both people are putting their best into it, it's so worth it.
Yeah. I agree. Mark, thank you for your honesty, your courage, your heart. I see all of it. And I would also love to share where our listeners can find your book.
Sure. Yeah, thanks. Also, before I get to that, though, I want to thank you. My book came out a while ago, and actually 6 years ago at this point. And I did a lot of talking about it then, but it's been a break, you know? And so you're just interest and curiosity, and the chance to now have someone with as generous of a heart as you clearly have to talk through this with. It's just, I just really appreciated this chance to talk. So thank you so much for like having me here. My book, which did come out in 2017, 7 years ago, and only includes the first three of five episodes. It's called My Lovely Wife in the Psych Ward. I doubt it's in bookstores anymore, but you can buy it online at typical online places. I do have a website. I don't do social media anymore. It's been a long time since I've done that. But I do have a website where if you want to drop me an email, I'll be happy to write you back and say hi.
Great. And we'll put it all in the show notes.
Cool.
Thank you, Mark. You are awesome.
Thank you, Kimmy. This was great.
I want to thank Mark for his bravery and candor in sharing his and Julia's story. And to Julia for allowing him to share it with us. It's moments like these that carve a path for greater understanding, compassion, and support towards mental health struggles. And for those of you who live with mental illness on a daily basis, the journey may be tough. It is tough. But remember, like Mark, never underestimate the power of love and the gift of wisdom that comes from the trials we face. And if you'd like to continue to reflect on this episode, be sure to listen to A Little Wiser next week, right back here. Thank you for listening to our 97th full-length episode of All the Wiser. Our team is associate producer Tara Daigle, editor and sound designer John LaSala, host Kimmy Culp, and I'm producer Erica Gerard. You may be wondering, what does a podcast producer actually do? Well, I mold and shape all the stories. I write the scripts and narration and generally keep the train on the tracks. I also do things like tell Kimmy when her voice sounds especially phlegmy today, or tell John, please turn down the volume of the music again.
Whoops, sorry.
We only have 2 episodes left until we reach our goal of 100 stories and close the show. Working on All the Wiser for the past 6 years has truly been the honor and privilege of my life. But we wouldn't have a show all these years if it wasn't for you guys, the listeners. We've got more to share with you over the next few weeks as we wind down the podcast, so be sure to keep listening, especially if you like hearing people cry. There will be crying. Until then, take care of yourselves and each other.
Hey,
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.